sure you do. And so Tom's going to speak for about 40 odd minutes. Do you want to kick us off, Tom?
Okay, well, friends and colleagues, I extend my welcome to this meeting as well. And obviously this part of the meeting is on the life of Che Guevara specifically. Obviously while that will cover some of the events around the Cuban Revolution, for stuff more about Cuba today and the nature of Cuba, then it's probably tomorrow's meeting that will cover that more. But as I'm sure everyone in this room is aware, that Che Guevara is one of the most famous revolutionaries that ever lived. And his image, in fact, is probably even better known than those of the leaders of the Russian Revolution, Lenin and Trotsky. And that famous picture has adorned millions of posters, t-shirts, mugs, stationery, pieces of graffiti, you name it, it's had Che's face on it. In fact, I've even heard of a pair of Che Guevara cufflinks. And in fact, even some big businesses have tried to get in on the popularity, as they would see it, of the Che Guevara brand. And that's, of course, something that Che himself would have despised and would have been horrified by. But notwithstanding this, his enduring popularity is due to the fact that he's seen as a symbol of struggle against capitalism and a symbol of the fight for a better world. And his picture, while it's not just adorned, you know, various student bedrooms, has also been carried and his name invoked on numerous workers' struggles worldwide, but particularly in his native Latin America. And today there are undoubtedly some people that wear his image simply as a fashion icon, but many people still look to him because of his role in the Cuban Revolution, because of his qualities as a determined and self-sacrificing revolutionary, as someone who refused the privileges of office, as an incorruptible internationalist. And as a new generation of young people look for alternatives to capitalism and embrace the need for socialist change, so too will they look to the likes of Che Guevara for inspiration and to some of the ideas that he put forward. And the task of Marxists when looking at his life is not just to salute and seek to emulate his indisputable qualities as a revolutionary, but also to examine the deficiencies in his understanding of Marxism and the mistakes that this led to him making. And, you know, these criticisms that we make of Che are not merely of an academic nature or simply for the point of scoring points against him. But, you know, they're absolutely vital questions as they informed both the nature of the Cuban Revolution and of the regime that emerged from that. But also, those mistakes were ultimately to prove fatal for Che himself. And at the age of just 39, he was murdered by the Bolivian army with the backing of the American CIA following a failed guerrilla struggle there in Bolivia. Now, nobody is born a revolutionary. And there was a particularly long political journey between the child born Ernesto Guevara Lynch de la Serna, born to middle-class parents of Irish and Spanish noble descent, actually, born in 1928 in Argentina. There's a long political journey between that child and El Che, the famous revolutionary that we all know of. And even by his untimely death in 1967, then his political ideas were still in a process of development. And there is evidence that he was reading the works of Trotsky, that he had a copy of The Revolution Betrayed, one of Trotsky's works, about Stalinism upon himself when he was captured at the time of his death. But it was through his experiences, what he saw on his journeys through Latin America, and through the revolutionary events that he observed and eventually became involved in, that Che Guevara, as we know him, was born. The name Che itself was a nickname given to him, and it stems from his Argentinian accent. Now, as a young man, Guevara studied to become a doctor. That reflects not just his class background, but also a desire to help the sick and the poor. And whilst studying at university, he did read the work of socialist poets and authors, but also of Marxists like Marx, Engels and Lenin. And however, despite a clear interest in socialist ideas that this reflected, he didn't profess to be a Marxist or a socialist even, and he didn't involve himself in any kind of organisation or become active around these ideas at that time. And it was his travels through Argentina, but particularly through the continent of Latin America at large, that changed this. But at that stage, as a student, he was not prepared to break with what was a rather bohemian background. And in fact, large parts of his travels and large parts of the diaries that he kept actually reflect more pleasure-seeking, carefree exuberance of a relatively well-heeled youth, rather than the making of a hardened revolutionary. Nonetheless, on his journey through Argentina in 1950, his first real travels that he went on, he witnessed the enormous gulf of a class divide that existed between what he described as the luxurious facade of the wealthy white population in Buenos Aires, and what he also described as the real soul of Argentina, the incredibly poor and downtrodden masses there. His first trip outside of Argentina through South America was in 1952 with his friend Alberto, and was to have more of a serious effect on him. And Guevara's accounts of this have been made, published as the Motorcycle Diaries, but also made into a film that came out a few years ago. And whilst this journey did have moments of political awakening, it too was mostly about youthful adventure. But a particularly significant moment in the development of Che as a revolutionary was his visit to the Chiqui mine in Chile, which was at the time the world's largest open cast copper mine. And it was here that he met a miner and his wife, who were both members of the then outlawed Chilean Communist Party. And their story of the repression that they and others had faced in the fight for workers' rights and the struggle for a better life left a lasting impression on him. And he was also there as a strike was being prepared. And this was his first experience at this stage as an outsider and an observer, but nonetheless his first experience of the class struggle. And describing his experience, he wrote about the exploited proletariat and condemned the destruction of the landscape for the profit of the American multinationals that owned the mine. And later on in the same journey, him and his companion Alberto made a stop in Peru, which also was to prove something of a turning point. Whilst there, he visited the Incan ruins of Machu Picchu, the rather amazing ruins apparently, which brought home to him the role of imperialism that had been played throughout the decades and centuries in the continent of Latin America, and the role with regards to Machu Picchu that Spanish imperialism has played in destroying and repressing the indigenous cultures and their people. But the dominant imperialist power in Latin America at that time, of course, was not the Spanish, but was the US, which dominated by ownership of the economy and by repression of those movements which threatened their interests. And during this trip, Guevara was to deepen his hatred of these Yankee gringos, as he referred to them, of US imperialism. It was also in Peru, in Lima, that he met and discussed with a leader of the Peruvian Communist Party, Dr. Pesci, and in a letter to this leader years later, he described how that meeting had provoked a great change in my attitude towards life and society. And so that again was a turning point, even in his own words. And whilst he still didn't consider himself a Marxist, he was certainly developing at least an internationalist viewpoint. And on a party to mark his 24th birthday, he gave a toast and declared that Latin America's division into illusory and uncertain nationalities is completely fictitious, and raised a toast for a united America. However, Guevara was still not politically active. He confined himself still to the role of observer in events and of a carefree traveller. He finished this set of travels in order to complete his medical training, which he did, finally qualifying as a doctor in June 1953. However, he had no plans to settle down in Argentina and begin practice as his parents would have liked, and quickly embarked on yet another journey around Latin America, this time with another friend known as Caliche. And he had no intention at this time of accepting the rigours of becoming a revolutionary. For him, the goal was yet more vagabonding, as he called it, travelling round and enjoying himself, and ultimately a desire to see India and the rest of the world. However, it was this journey that was to prove far more significant, and the experiences that he went through there determined not only the course of the rest of his life, but also played a part in shaping history of Cuba in particular. In July 1953, the two friends arrived in La Paz in Bolivia, which was at the time being rocked by revolutionary upheavals. The previous year, a mass uprising there had brought to power the Movimiento Nacionalista Revolucionario. The pressure of the mass movement had forced this reformist government into enacting huge changes on behalf of working class and oppressed people. They brought about land reforms and they nationalised the tin mines. However, they never completed a break with capitalism, and they never built a workers' state to defend these gains, and the movement eventually ended in defeat. Nonetheless, the movements that Che witnessed while in Bolivia were more than he'd ever seen before, and he extended his stay to over a month in order to see as much as he could. Despite the fact that they were a minority of society at the time, the working class, particularly the tin miners, played an absolutely key role in this struggle, helping win in land reform for the peasants, but also gains for themselves. And these workers were strongly organised and disciplined from their experiences of working in the mines, and they'd also armed themselves as well. However, despite these experiences, what he witnessed while in Bolivia, Che never really fully grasped or applied the importance of the role and the power of the working class in the struggle for socialism. And this was the case even upon his fatal return to Bolivia a number of years later. And whilst he was there, Che discussed with a number of different political activists, and as I say, extended his stay, but his role was still that of an outside observer, albeit a very interested one, rather than an active participant within the struggles. And it was to be in Guatemala, his next stop on his travels, that this was to change. Although the effect of his Bolivian experience was very clear to see in a letter that he wrote to his aunt in December 1953, where he wrote, "I won't rest until I see these capitalist octopuses annihilated. In Guatemala, I will perfect myself and achieve what I need to become an authentic revolutionary." And in the same letter, he signed it off, proclaiming his shining faith in the socialist future. And arriving in Guatemala on Christmas Eve, 53, it was here that he first actively identified with a political cause. The president of Guatemala at the time was a reformist called Arbenz. And in 1952, the previous year, he'd enacted land reforms and the nationalisation of the hated and US-owned United Fruit Company that dominated huge swathes of the economy and was absolutely repressive towards the workers there. And these actions had propelled Arbenz into conflict with US imperialism and with the Guatemalan rich and elite. And the masses supported the actions that he'd taken, and a revolutionary movement arose to defend them, which attracted thousands of left-wingers from across the continent. Che met with and discussed with a large number of these, including some Cuban exiles who were involved in the movement to depose the dictatorship there, but not at that stage Fidel Castro. He was to meet him later. And his political ideas also developed further during his active participation in this struggle. He began to criticise the communist parties at the time, and particularly their Popular Front policy. And this policy of the Stalinist communist parties meant that they had to make alliances with the so-called progressive capitalist classes of the countries, the national capitalist classes, in order to defeat imperialism, and said that in Latin America, capitalism was not fully developed enough, and therefore the working class was not strong enough or ready to take power for themselves. And this policy sadly led to the defeat of many cases, in many cases, as those so-called progressive capitalists were quite prepared to use bloody repression against the workers in order to defend their own interests and their own profits. However, whilst correctly criticising this approach, Che did not propose an alternative to it, and certainly did not know of, or at least understand, Trotsky's theory of the permanent revolution, which I'll come back to in a bit. And like in Bolivia, the Arbenz government in Guatemala had not dismantled the capitalist state, despite the measures that it had taken, nor had built for itself organs through which the working class and poor could run society. And this led to his eventual overthrow by a CIA-backed force in 1954. And it was after this defeat that Che eventually made his way to Mexico. He got out of the country. And it was here in Mexico that he continued his political development, continued to develop his ideas by again studying the works of Marx, Engels and Lenin, but also the works of Mao as well, the Chinese communist. And it was also in Mexico in 1955 where he met Fidel Castro, who'd recently been released from prison in Cuba and, on the condition that he left the country. And he joined the July 26th movement, which Castro led. And this movement was named after an assault on a military barracks in Cuba on that date, July 26th, in 1953, which Castro had led, and which had led to Castro's subsequent imprisonment. And this, the July 26th movement, was a guerrilla movement with the intention of overthrowing the hated Batista dictatorship in Cuba that you know, really gripped and dominated Cuban society at that time. And Cuba of the 1950s was the playground of American imperialism. They dominated the economy there, and you know, the lives of ordinary workers and peasants were largely run in order to meet the profits of these big American companies. Wealthy Americans treated Cuba as their playground, as their holiday home, and they frequented the many Havana brothels and casinos. Castro saw the struggle that he was leading as being to overthrow the dictatorship in Cuba rather than to end capitalism there. What he wanted to do was build a modern, independent, but still capitalist state there, but bringing democracy and some reforms for the poor. But, you know, as I say, ultimately, not to overthrow capitalism or to build a socialist society at that stage. And even after the overthrow of Batista in 1959, some months after that, Castro was still declaring that he was not a communist, and was saying to the Association of Bankers there that he would not nationalise any industries. By the start of the guerrilla campaign, Che was an avowed socialist, but saw this movement as a way to get active in the struggle, despite the fact that it was not an explicitly socialist movement. He too saw the communist parties at the time as being too passive and too keen to collaborate with other forces in society in order to get into power. He wanted something that was seen as more radical, seen as more active. And however, as I've said, he did not know or accept the theory of the permanent revolution. And this was written by Trotsky really as a guide to action in those underdeveloped countries like Cuba, where elements of feudalism still existed, where a peasant class rather than a working class was a large social force within society. And this theory, the theory of the permanent revolution, stated that the developing capitalist class in these countries was tied to the old landlords and was dominated by imperialism, and therefore it couldn't play the independent role that it had in the established capitalist countries like Britain during the capitalist revolutions there, and therefore that you shouldn't align yourself with these so-called progressive capitalists. And these national capitalist classes were too weak and incapable of carrying out their historic role and the tasks of what we would call the bourgeois democratic revolution. that is the tasks that were carried through on the birth of capitalism in countries like Britain, such as land reform, the ending of feudal relations on the land, the giving of land to the peasants, and the creation of a bourgeois democracy, a parliamentary democracy, and an independent and unified nation state. Trotsky argued that the working class, even when a minority within society, must take a lead within revolutionary events, in alliance with and drawing behind them the poor peasantry and other oppressed layers in society, in order to carry out these tasks and to give the land to the peasant, and that the capitalist class was incapable of carrying through these tasks. But he also argued that workers wouldn't stop there, that they would go over then from the tasks of the bourgeois democratic revolution to the tasks of the socialist revolution, of expropriating the property of the capitalist class, of taking it into collective ownership, and of establishing a planned economy and a workers' democracy. And despite the relatively small size of the working class in Russia in 1917, it was an absolute minority of society, far smaller even than the working class in Cuba in the 50s. The Russian Revolution followed this course. Trotsky's theory of the permanent revolution proved to be indeed a guide to action, and was justified with the victory of that revolution. The leadership of which included Lenin, but also of course Trotsky himself. And the result in Russia following that was a relatively healthy workers' state at that time, although the low level of industrialisation at the time and the attack by imperialist armies from all sides meant that building socialism in Russia was a very difficult task. And Lenin and Trotsky understood the need to spread that revolution internationally, particularly to the key industrialised countries like Britain and especially Germany. Unfortunately, this didn't happen, and it's obviously a task not for this session but to another to really examine this. But the Russian Revolution was left isolated, and in these conditions a bureaucratic elite was able to rise above society, and under Stalin was able to choke out the existence of workers' democracy. And so Russia, over the course of a period of time, became what we described as a deformed workers' state. But this is not how it began. But in distinction to Trotsky's theory of the permanent revolution, which I appreciate I've spent some time going into, I think it's necessary to compare that to what Che's ideas were at the time. So in distinction to that, Che saw the peasantry, rather than the organised working class, the industrial working class, as playing a key role in the revolution in Cuba. And this is despite the relative size and the strength, as I mentioned, of the working class in Cuba at that time as compared to Russia in 1917. Nonetheless, in a speech, Che described how the worker at times becomes a privileged individual. And it's true that the working class were relatively better off than the mass of the peasantry in Cuba. But this did not mean in any sense that they were privileged or that they had any stake in the continuation of the status quo. They were oppressed, they were under the heel of the Batista dictatorship, and their lives, as I said, were run for the profit of the US big business. Che also saw a guerrilla struggle basing itself upon the peasantry as being the most effective means of forcing social change in a country like Cuba. In these ideas, he was influenced by a number of factors. One being his own class background, and the fact that he had not, up until this point, been actively involved in any organisation in the workers' movement. That played a part, as did, of course, the virtual abandonment of any independent working class approach by the Stalinist communist parties in Latin America at that time. But he was also influenced by the continent's rich histories of peasant wars, and by the Peruvian Dr. Pesce, who I mentioned before, and by the victory in China in 1949 of Mao's peasant army there, which led about the breaking with capitalism and landlordism in that country. And as I've said, Che had read a number of Mao's writings by that point. Now, as Marxists, we see this approach that Che took as being flawed. He did not grasp the immense revolutionary potential of the working class and how the organisation of that class in the workplaces, in industry, gives them a different experience and outlook to that of the peasantry. Nonetheless, despite this significant failing, when he applied himself to the guerrilla struggle, he did so completely and self-sacrificingly. He was utterly determined, utterly committed to the struggle, and devoted his whole life from that point on to the cause of revolution. While still in Mexico, he trained hard as a guerrilla fighter, and plagued his entire life by a severe asthma. He needed to be extra fit over and above that of the other fighters with him, and took it upon himself to make sure that that was the case, with rigorous physical training, but also political reading and discussion with his comrades there. Now, as events proved, Castro's vision of what he was trying to create, an independent, democratic, capitalist Cuba, was impossible. Under the pressure of the masses, aroused by the revolutionary events, and as a result of factors that I'll come back to explain a little bit more later on, the Cuban Revolution did end with the overthrow of landlordism and capitalism. And in this way, it did, in a way, vindicate the theory of the permanent revolution, but it did so in a distorted way. The capitalist class had proved itself incapable of establishing a modern capitalist Cuba, and in fact there was the necessity to go over to the tasks of the socialist revolution. But this happened without the working class in the lead. And for this reason, and also because of the existing model of the Soviet Union, Stalinist countries, there was not a workers' democracy built in Cuba. In fact, from the outset, the so-called socialism that was built in Cuba was built as a deformed workers' state, similar to what existed in Russia in that time, but not similar to the healthy workers' state that existed in Russia following the revolution there. A planned economy was built, but this was not controlled by a workers' democracy, but was dominated and controlled by a bureaucratic elite basing itself on one-party rule. But all of this nearly didn't happen. It was just 82 guerrillas, fighters, that boarded the boat from Mexico bound for Cuba. Castro and Che Guevara obviously amongst them. And the beginning of the campaign was almost farcical, actually. As the boat, the Granma, approached the Cuban coast, the navigator fell overboard. They arrived in Cuba on the 2nd of December in 1956, which was 2 days later than they'd intended to arrive there. And as a result, the party that they had waiting there to greet and supply them had disappeared. They came ashore in broad daylight, a mile short of their intended landing point, and they were spotted by the Air Force at the time, so, you know, not a particularly auspicious start to the guerrilla struggle, to say the least. They were split into two groups, which wandered around lost for 2 days, before eventually being able to regroup and head into the Sierra Maestra Mountains in the east of the Cuban island, where they were to begin the guerrilla struggle. And just 20 of that original landing party actually remained by this point of regroupment. Yet, in just over 2 years' time from that inauspicious beginning, on New Year's Day in 1959, this movement had forced the hated dictator Batista to flee the island and was beginning the building of a new Cuba. Now, Che had the theory that a guerrilla struggle would ignite a revolutionary movement, the example that the guerrillas gave would inspire others to struggle. This wasn't quite what happened, however. Although the guerrillas were able to draw on the support of the peasants, this was a largely passive support. It was a war that was being fought on behalf of the mass of society, rather than with their active participation. And the role of the working class was even more limited. sorry. The July 26th movement had just a limited base within the cities. It was mostly based on the rural peasantry. And the strongest party amongst industrial workers in Cuba at the time was what was to become the Cuban Communist Party, the Partido Socialista Popular, or PSP. Although this had been partly compromised by previous support and engagement with the Batista regime, the July 26th movement called a general strike on the 9th of April 1958, but without building for it properly amongst workers, and as a result it proved to be a complete flop. The next time there was a general strike, the next time that workers took a particularly active role, it was at the time that Batista was already fleeing, and it was being called to greet the guerrillas as they entered the cities. The working class in that case had been reduced largely to the role of cheerleaders of these guerrillas. Nonetheless, the guerrillas did gain support for their struggle. The social base of the Batista regime was collapsing around its ears, and they were seen as the ones doing most to combat him. They won many people to their ranks for this reason, but also, when they captured soldiers from the regime, they didn't execute them. Instead, they discussed with them and let them go. This was the case for ordinary soldiers. And especially as the struggle progressed, they were able to win fighters from the army and over to the guerrilla struggle. And this was in marked contrast, of course, to the approach that the army took when they captured guerrillas. During the struggle, Che was marked out and elevated himself as an heroic fighter, both daring and self-sacrificing. He never asked others to take on a mission that he wasn't prepared to do himself. And he also organised political discussion amongst the fighters of his column and argued for socialist ideas within the July 26th movement. This movement contained many different political trends. It was held together, to be honest, just by a desire to overthrow Batista. And sometimes these trends came into conflict. There were sharp discussions about the way forward. But despite this, and despite the tiny beginnings of the struggle, the movement grew in strength. With no other political force within Cuba consistently opposing the disintegrating Batista regime, there was a vacuum into which they were able to move. And on the 1st of January, New Year's Day 1959, as their forces were entering the city, then Batista, the hated dictator, fled the country. The July 26th movement, as I said, called a general strike to mark the end of the old regime. And this greeted the guerrillas as Che led a march into Havana and Castro into Santiago. The tactic of the guerrilla war had worked, but because of the specific social and political conditions that existed in Cuba at that time, and it wasn't to be so successful everywhere. In fact, it was in an attempt to repeat the same struggle under different conditions in Bolivia that was to prove a fatal mistake for Che. As I've already mentioned, despite Che actually arguing for it consistently, the intention of Castro and many of the other leaders of the July 26th movement was never to break with capitalism. Even after Batista had been deposed, in March 1959, he announced that he had no intention of nationalising any industries. And it was not until April the following year that he described the revolution in Cuba as being socialist. It was partly the pressure of the masses aroused by this revolutionary process that pushed the regime further than they had ever intended into nationalising land and industry. But also the role of US imperialism was a factor. Although in the very early stages of the guerrilla struggle, they thought that they might be able to control or at least come to some accommodation with Castro and the fighters, then they soon decided that he was beyond the pale. Even the relatively benign measures that he proposed or took against their interests were completely unacceptable to them, and they retaliated against the new Cuban regime. They were horrified at losing their playground in the Caribbean, and in particular, the figure of Che Guevara absolutely terrified them. The role of US imperialism in forcing the hand of the Cubans was recognised by Che in an article in 1963 where he wrote, Each blow dealt by imperialism called for a response. Every time the Yankees acted with their habitual arrogance by taking some measure against Cuba, we had to adopt the necessary countermeasures, and thereby the revolution deepened. In July 1960, the US cut the sugar quota, which was crucial to the Cuban economy. The USSR, the Soviet Union, stepped in and took that quota. And in retaliation to the actions of the US, and under the influence of their new trading partner, Cuba took greater and greater steps against capitalism, eventually completely taking over the economy and building a plan. The PSP, which I mentioned before, later to become the Communist Party, have played an incredibly limited role within the revolution. But nonetheless, as this new regime developed, they were merged with the July 26th movement and became the organ of one-party rule and the control of the planned economy. And this was partly under the influence of the Soviet Union. And as the workers had not played an active role in the revolution, so too their role in the subsequent running of society was passive. From the outset, the planned economy in Cuba was not controlled by a workers' democracy, but by a bureaucratic elite. This reflected, as I've said, the nature of the revolution, but also the pre-existing model of Stalinism in the Soviet Union that was supporting them. And while there were mass meetings in the streets that technically had a say on affairs and policies, then in reality the role of these was simply to rubber stamp decisions of the bureaucracy. There was no option of these meetings to discuss, to debate, or to amend policies that came down from above, but simply they had to vote, si or no, yes or no. Despite the deformed nature of the workers' state in Cuba, however, the benefits that even the bureaucratically planned economy brought still made themselves apparent very quickly in the lives of the previously impoverished Cubans. In particular, education and healthcare were massively improved. Under the Batista regime, just half of school children, children of school age, actually had any formal education. This was quickly made available to everyone under the new regime, and within 2 years, illiteracy was abolished. By the late 70s in Cuba, life expectancy was at 74 years, roughly the same as Britain at the time, and considerably more than other comparable Latin American countries. For example, Brazil's was just 60, and Bolivia's just 45. While there have been encroachments on the planned economy, these gains of the revolution still exist in Cuba today. Now, with the bureaucracy that existed in Cuba, came privileges that they took for themselves. These were limited compared to those taken by the bureaucracy in the Soviet Union, but only because of the relative wealth of the two nations. And still, many within the new regime put themselves up in what had formerly been the houses of the rich. And when food rationing began in 1961, they made sure that they had the best rations for themselves. And cars, for a long period, were a preserve only of Communist Party officials. But none of this was for change, showing the same spirit of self-sacrifice and commitment that he had during the revolution. Che rejected absolutely these privileges. Upon finding out that his food ration was higher than those given to the mass of the population, he had it cut accordingly. He took less wages than he was entitled to in order not to be wealthier than the ordinary Cuban, and he was angry at those that didn't do the same. He took on work in industry and agriculture, working alongside ordinary workers, putting in weekend shifts. And this willingness to pitch in and reject privilege earned him an enormous amount of respect, and is part of the reason that he's still a place in the heart and is still looked to by workers in struggle across Latin America and the world to this day. Now, during his time in Cuba, Che's dissatisfaction and unease grew at the bureaucracy. He was especially disturbed by his visits to the USSR, a country that he previously considered to be the ideal model of socialism. Seeing it up close proved to him that it was otherwise. And upon one visit, he was dining there with officials, and they had a marvellous meal, served on the porcelain plates of the finest quality, and he turned to his hosts and joked sarcastically, "So, the proletariat here eats off French porcelain, hey?" Despite this instinctive repulsion, Che had never had a worked out alternative to this bureaucratic rule. And this is in distinction to Leon Trotsky, who devoted the latter part of his life to fighting the Stalinists and argued the need for political revolution. This would defend the gains of the planned economy, but cast aside the bureaucracy and establish a workers' democracy. Such an event, were it to happen in Cuba today, would be a beacon to the whole of Latin America and would unleash a tremor felt across the world in the same way that the Cuban Revolution did in 1959. And as a determined internationalist, Che understood the effect that this revolution had had at the time. And in 1962, he stated, "Our revolution is endangering all American possessions in Latin America. We are telling these countries to make their own revolution." And he was determined to help with this spread. By 1965, his disillusionment with the bureaucracy was merging with a greater desire to return to active struggle. And at that time, he left Cuba for the Congo with a band of guerrillas in order to link up with fighters there. He left a letter to Castro when he left Cuba, signed off with the famous phrase, "Hasta la victoria siempre," always until victory. And almost immediately, however, this Congolese expedition ran into trouble. The Congolese guerrillas there were attempting to impose a struggle upon the people of Congo that they knew little about. The leader drove about in a Mercedes-Benz, and far from winning the support of the local peasants, often they terrorised them, robbing them and assaulting the women. And Che described them as being a parasitic army. Needless to say, this struggle did not go the same way as the Cuban Revolution. And following its defeat, Che had to make good his escape from the country and eventually made a clandestine return to Cuba, unwilling to openly return empty-handed and unvictorious. His next attempt to ignite a revolution was in Bolivia, where he emerged with a band of guerrilla fighters in 1967. Whilst his failure to understand the role of the working class in revolution had in part led to the bureaucratic nature of the regime in Cuba, due to the specific conditions that existed in that country at the time, the guerrilla struggle had proved successful. In Bolivia, however, these conditions didn't exist, and the potential for guerrilla struggle was far more limited. His attempt to apply the same tactics as he had in Cuba was to prove fatal. Bolivia had a much more powerful working class with a long and glorious tradition of struggle led by the tin miners, which Che himself had seen in struggle years before. And also, during that first visit of Che's, a land reform had been enacted, meaning that the peasantry had the land. They were less inclined to give support to a guerrilla struggle. The campaign was also very badly planned. It started in a sparsely populated area of the country, one with no real history of struggle. And Che's attempt to detonate a revolutionary movement was in reality an attempt to impose one from the outside. And whilst this was an heroic act, it was nonetheless one of desperation and was doomed to failure. Che's forces at their peak numbered only in the tens, and stood no chance against the thousands of the CIA-backed Bolivian army. On the 8th of October 1967, his guerrilla fighters were captured. And the following day, Che was interrogated and then murdered, shot upon the orders of a CIA agent. And brave to the last, his reported final words to his executioner were, "Shoot, coward. You are only going to kill a man." So in conclusion, comrades, Che Guevara's position as an icon, as a symbol of struggle, is justified. This is because of his indisputable qualities as a revolutionary. Qualities like his daring, his commitment to the revolutionary cause, his unbending internationalism, but above all, his utter spirit of self-sacrifice, are ones that we should not just learn from, but seek to emulate for ourselves. But our study of his life should not just be simply uncritical of the mistakes that he made. Its lack of a fully Marxist understanding of the struggle for socialism was sadly to be his undoing, although he was developing his political understanding through his whole life. And as I said, there's evidence that he was reading the works of Trotsky at the time of his death. And had his life not been cut short, then who knows where his lifelong political journey would have ended up. If the new generation of workers and young people who are drawn to the image of Che and to the fight against capitalism can not just admire him, but also learn from his life, then this will be a great aid in the struggle for a socialist future. This struggle is as important now as it was during his lifetime, and it's one that we must make our own. In the words of Che, always until victory.